This is XTP Media.
The OAC managed to beat Pan Am across the Atlantic because Pan Am had assumed that they would be the first. Even though BO was not operating 7-0s, we had a little Dibley's Air Force, they called it.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 92 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. And of course, Tim is the editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to be here.
And Gareth Stringer, the editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, welcome. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Peter. Hi, Tim. Good to be back again.
Yep, the boys are back in podcast town.
It's going to be an episode full of outtakes.
Lock up your grandmothers.
How are we all?
Yeah, very well. Yeah, good. Good. Looking forward to it. Look, we've got a cracking episode today. Even if I say myself.
Yeah. Tim has this interview that's coming up is, and I'm not just saying this because he's on the other end of a Skype line, one of the most interesting and entertaining interviews I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, it is. It's a long episode. We know that. We just couldn't cut anything out of it. So we're really grateful for the Royal Aeronautical Society for allowing us to use this content. But stick around. It's a great interview. We do have some news to talk through. There are a few things that have caught our eye we want to have a chat about. Talk a little bit about Paris. We've got the air show coming up. And also a mention for Global Aviation Resource, who are, of course, 10 this year. So want to pick that up with Gareth. Some great content coming through that stream at the moment. But for the moment, let's see what caught our eye in the news. Well, we can't get by without discussing Boeing and the 737 MAX and the whole issue surrounding that. Tim, you've just come back from a trip to Boeing. And whilst I don't really want to focus on all the issues of the MAX, as they're already well publicised, what's the feeling stateside about the aircraft? Because it's very quiet at the moment. We know there's a lot to be done. But what's the feeling on the other side of the pond?
Well, I mean, you know, the MAX. I mean, where do you start with this? We could have a whole episode. We could have several episodes devoted to what's going on at the moment. It's been so early in the year. It's been so fast moving. Things have been changing so fast. I was with Boeing Defense on the defense side of things, and you could really. So MAX really did come up. You know, it's a different part of the company, but there is a sort of a state of shock, disbelief, and somebody's already sort of mentioned this already of you know, like a parent's going through a divorce. You know, no one wants to sort of talk about it. So there was that kind of undercurrent of shock and these people. You know, these people I was interacting with, they do their job very seriously. They're very diligent. They're very safety focused. You know, some of the best engineers you can wish for. And yet there is this kind of big black cloud, you know, hanging over the company at the moment. And no one really knows, you know, where the light at the end of the tunnel is, or if there, you know, what happens next. So, you know, for a recap, I think where we are at the moment is Boeing says that it's done the software updates. It's done changes to the MCAS software. That was the core of this. It's adjusted the training. So now it is going back to the FAA and looking for authorization to get the you know the grounding lifted and get the aircraft flying back in the air. And that's I think that's the key thing. This is to once you get the aircraft flying back in the air, and people see it, it's working, it's flying again. And that's a key kind of psychological stage. The problem is it's now a little bit out of Boeing's hands and even the FAA's hands because. You've now got international regulators, EASA, sort of Chinese, Canada, all wanting reassurance that you know that the problem's fixed and that the FAA is on top of things again. And so even if the FAA were to, and I think you know, this probably be unlikely to come out tomorrow and sort of say, yeah, you could. American airlines, you can fly it. You're still waiting on the rest of the world to make their mind up and to reassure them. And that's really, really, you know, given the split now, the cracks that have opened up in the international regulatory system, the division between the US and other aviation regulators, this is still a sort of a major challenge and a major, you know, where are we now? You know,
It's the bread and butter aircraft for Boeing, isn't it? 737, and you know the highest produced airliner, jet airliner of all time. It's the staple product from their fleet. They've got financial problems because the financial markets are also uncomfortable with the way they've conducted themselves. But I suppose the thing that intrigues me more than anything else is general popular opinion, because for the first time you've got swathes of people on social media who probably would never known about some of the detail, and you know I know some of the airlines in the States are having great challenges and will have them when they bring the aircraft back, encouraging passengers back on to the aircraft, because the whole brand of the 737 MAX is so heavily tarnished. Do you think they'll change the name of the aircraft? Do you think they'll re-promote it some way?
Well, I mean, there's two schools of thought here. One school of thought is obviously the lowest cost ticket wins out, and that people aren't. You know, the general public, you know, by and large, don't know what aircraft they're getting on. They don't sort of distinguish between the different types, you know, you know, once it starts flying again and people sort of the news headlines kind of die down, then people won't think twice, you know. And also it's convenience, you know. Are you really going to sort of say, well, you know, the flight I want is got a max on there, so I'm going to drive 12 hours instead, you know.
How do the airlines like Southwest bring these aircraft back? Because there's some articles in the press, Reuters were reporting that each aircraft's going to need up to 150 hours of prep before getting into flight, let alone the software upgrades. They've been sat around for so long. It's a monumental project to get these aircraft back in the air, isn't it?
I would imagine that if you store aircraft, obviously you drain the hydraulics, you put the you spray them with coatings to stop the kind of canopies kind of fading and things like that. You know, if you're going to put it on the desert, you do all that stuff because it's long-term storage, you know. Yeah. It's not It's not sticking a hanger. So if you've gone through all that business of draining all the hydraulics, all the fuel systems, all the rest of it, shutting it completely down, then yeah, I would imagine it's going to take a lot of work to put it back, you know, to get it up and so as it all starts up when you press the start button. Mm. Just to go back to your previous point, though, you know, the flip side of the coin, though, and you've already kind of pointed that out. Of passengers won't notice. Is we're in a different age than the Comet, the DC-10, even the Dreamliner. You know, the Dreamliner, yeah. I mean, you know, there was internet, but there wasn't Twitter constantly pushing out instant sort of reactions. And you weren't, you know, in the 787 days, you didn't have the, you know, the CEO getting, you know, kind of personal abuse really on sort of social media that you have now, you know. So it's kind of shot up the, you know, the Max brand or the Max, you know, the news story has kind of got higher than you know, probably DC-10 or even 787. You know, yeah. No one died in the 787. It was quickly forgotten about.
Yeah, interesting. Well, no one wants to see this, and we do hope it's resolved very soon. Let's leave the Max there. And come back across this side of the pond. Gareth, the Dam Busters are on the move. F-35s are going abroad.
Yeah, they've gone off to Cyprus for an exercise called Lightning Dawn, is it? Is that right off the top of my head? Yeah, exercise Lightning Dawn. And this is a big deal, really, I think, to take these incredibly complex aircraft abroad to deploy them for the first time. And I think half a dozen of the jets have gone. They're going to be based at RF Akrotiri in Cyprus. It's a big deal. It's an exercise in sort of mobility and operability. And, you know, it's they've spent time obviously working up with the aircraft now, getting comfortable at RAF Marham. So it's up sticks and go abroad for the first time, which is something they will undoubtedly have to do and will do a lot more in the years and months ahead. It's quite a big deal. So hopefully it's all going well. And if anyone is on holiday in Cyprus, maybe they've got some F-35s floating around at the moment.
I haven't seen any photos, actually, around. It's been very quiet, other than the original news articles. Not really heard much about it.
No, I mean, it's not the easiest place to get very close to from memory. And I guess security is probably pretty tight as well. There were some official pictures of the aircraft arriving in Cyprus, but I haven't seen anything else at all.
Right. Okay. Well, that'd be interesting to see how they perform overseas. Tim, back to you. As we record this, it's the 28th of May. Next week is Paris. What's the expectation, given, I suppose, our first news story and interest there? What can we expect of Paris this year?
Okay, well, Paris, starts on the, let's see, 17th.
Oh, okay, 17th. We're a few weeks away.
So we're a couple of weeks away.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think we've got to go back to the Max. There actually is going to be on people's lips at Paris. You know, the one story that might have been a big story in commercial aerospace was you know, before all this happened was you know, the Boeing's middle of the market, middle sized aeroplane, you know, the long awaited 757 replacement, and see whether there's any movement on that. I think, you know, sales are going to be you know, very, very subdued. You know, I think it was last month for Airbus and Boeing recorded no sales. There'll be some sort of stuff maybe sort of saved up for people. You can expect, obviously, Airbus are celebrating their 50th anniversary this month, so there will be sort of celebrations there for their half century. There's going to be some interesting stuff around the fringes, maybe in electric, hybrid electric aviation. I think we can probably look forward to that. And then maybe something a little bit on sort of brought forward from July, and people looking at Apollo and kind of celebrating the sort of space aspect Lip Auger. Yeah. But on the civil side, I think we were pretty subdued, and people's kind of, at least in the sort of sales extravaganza, usually sort of sales extravaganza that we all kind of know.
Tim, there's obviously a massive PR element of these events. How do you think Boeing play it? Do they come out fighting, or are they going to try and talk about other things, bearing in mind that everybody's only going to want to talk about one thing? How do you see it playing out potentially?
If I knew that, I'd be making a lot of money advising them.
Okay, what
different? What would you do to advise them?
I don't see how they can. I don't see how they can get around it. I think in some respects, put it this way, this is the perfect opportunity to explain to the technical press what fixes you've put in, what you're doing, and why it's not going to happen again, and to reassure people. And the technical press are they're your worst enemies in some sense, but they're also your best friends in that if you can convince that if you can win over the technical press, the aviation press, that as at Paris they're there, they're looking for news. And you can come out there and you can be sincere, and you can sort of say, this is what the situation is, and this is what we're doing, and here's what procedures we're putting in place, so it's not going to happen again. That would be, and you then you've got the technical press that go away with that in mind. I think that would go a great way to then having that knowledge or that message percolate outwards to the wider press who don't understand aviation. And in these cases, they do rely on the technical press and the aviation press for leads, a steer, what's going on. Yeah. So, it's going to be rough for them. But at the same time, it isn't as an opportunity. As sad as it is, with these people who've lost their lives, let's remember that aviation safety is unbelievably it's still unbelievably safe. Despite this massive growth, despite all these new aeroplanes that are being flown every year, so I think we're going to have a little bit of perspective and not kind of immediately throw the baby out with the bathwater and sort of say, flying suddenly got dangerous. It has.
Okay, well, let's leave that there then. While we're on air shows, anyone up for any air show? We're just about to hit the air show season. I'm down for Yeovilton as always. Going to any others?
You get some Harrier action then, because they're doing that. And
very excited. Right,
there's a pair coming in, I think, isn't there, from Spain, which is brilliant. How bizarre to think of that as being a real treat. That's the way it is these days.
It is. F-35 will be there, so that'll be interesting, because it's not the largest field around, so relatively close. Not great for photography though, but looking forward to that. Some interesting foreign visitors. The French will be there again. That'll be exciting. They've just run away with everyone's hearts the last few years.
Probably worth it for that alone, I would say.
I know, and the noise, they really know how to tear up the sky. Some interesting visitors as well. Some historic aircraft from France are coming across. I just noticed today the Black Cats had got their PDA, so they're going to perform. That's good. And of course the end finale with the commando. The commando action is always worth it. So I'm going with my 8-year-old daughter again. She's got a red arrows cap ready. So looking forward to it.
Cool.
Fantastic.
Anything else on the radar catching anyone's eyes?
Go ahead.
Sorry, Tim. Go on.
Flying Legends. So hopefully get to Flying Legends in July. I went down to see them for a little bit of a sneak preview, and I had a kind of nice little kind of VIP tour behind the scenes at Dunksford in the hangar, and so good to sort of see them, you know, and see what's going on there. I mean, you know, it's the traditional Legends weekend that you know miss at your peril.
Is some great historic stuff though at the moment, isn't there? We've got some wonderful historic aircraft this side of the pond. We're very lucky.
Yeah, we are, and it's good, bearing in mind everything that's happened in the last few years, to see, you know, these events are still, you know, they're still being put in the calendar. They're still attracting big crowds and lots of aircraft, and you know, the air shows might not be what they used to be. You know, a lot of people bemoan that fact, but I don't think we should, you know, that's not taken for granted. We still got them. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, you just said about taking your daughter. It's still a huge opportunity to inspire the pilots, engineers, air traffickers, whatever it might be of the future.
Let's leave that there. Just before we go off the news, though, one of the things I did want to mention was Global Aviation Resources' 10th anniversary, Gareth. I know we mentioned it very briefly last time out. Some really, really good content coming up. Loved the E6 feature. Yeah. I know you've been digging into the archives. And sometimes, you know, when people do that, it's like, yeah, same old, same old. But some of the stuff you're putting out there at the moment is just fascinating.
Well, firstly, thank you very much for those kind words. I guess there's a couple of different things there. First thing is 10 years. It's like, wow, you know, can't believe it, really. You know, I still remember very, very clearly getting a phone call from Carl Drage, you know, who was editor, yep, for a long time, saying, look, we've got this website and we saw a couple of things you've done and we wondered if you'd like to be involved. And as I said in the editorial that I prepared, you know, I, during the course of that phone call, I thought, oh, writing, yeah, I like that. Aviation, yeah, I like that. And so I said yes straight away, and you know, nobody knew at that point where it would take us. And it's been brilliant. We all love it. You know, it's been a hobby for all of us since the day one. The guys and girls that are involved now have all got proper jobs, as I always say. And the second part of it really is, you know, people who follow the website closely will know that, yeah, we don't publish as religiously as we used to. We used to publish, you know, God, sometimes like three or four pieces a week, you know, and we don't do that anymore. But some people know I've unfortunately had quite an extended period of time off of work. And one thing I have been able to do is type. And it all kind of started with the tornado stuff that I decided that we weren't going to allow Tornado to retire from Royal Air Force Service without giving her a blooming good send off on Global Aviation Resource. So of course, that turned into this massive labour of love. And then one of the chaps said, oh, I think we photographed all of the BA retro schemes now. That turned into a complete history of British Airways, yeah, liveries.
Great article. Great article.
With some incredible images from the archives, particularly Doug Green, who's was an airline pilot and been photographing aircraft for a long time. And in fact, actually, we've got a couple more lined up. I've written quite a long piece on the Caravelle, is an aircraft that when I was a kid, you know, and we'd go abroad on holidays, you know, you'd see it was doing charter flights and it, you know, Avon engines, and it was noisy and it was French and it was beautiful. And I just thought, you know what, I quite fancy writing about the Caravelles. Obviously that's turned into this sort of monstrous piece as well, which will come out in due course. And yeah, there's some other things. I know some of the guys have got some red flag content. Some of them are at NATO Tiger Meet. That's coming up. And this is a spoiler, actually. I've written a very long piece on the Aviation Foundations of Apollo 11. So I've taken a look at all of the aircraft most closely associated with Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins. And that's been great fun. That's been really good fun doing that. We publish when we've got something to publish these days, but we still try and make sure that it's the best quality it can possibly be. And we've still got new people finding us from all over the world, which is absolutely lovely. And I'm very proud of it. I don't mind saying that. There's a big archive of aviation content there, which as long as the internet still exists, it will still exist. And that's quite nice, isn't it? You know, you're actually doing something that will be there for sort of in time memoriam. So long may it continue.
Well, I'll tell you a little caravel story. When I was on honeymoon, we went to the south of France and we were wandering around.
We should have some music playing.
We went on a Q400. And slap bang in the middle of nowhere, I stumbled across a caravel. I mean, literally, it was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen. And I eventually did track the story down. I should dig that out and maybe put it in the show notes. But somebody who basically had got this caravel, taken the wings off it, dragged it into the middle of the country, put the wings on it, and just given up. But there's my caravel story. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Very quickly, Paul Filmer, who's one of our writers and photographers, has got a massive archive of pictures on his own website. And whenever we do anything, he always says to me, go onto the website, just do a search for the aircraft you're looking for, tell me which pictures you want, and I'll send them to you. And then we drop them into whichever feature. So I went on and searched for the caravel, SE210, and he's got loads of pictures. And I chose a few, and there was a couple of these aircraft in the middle of nowhere. And anyway, I chose them because there was some nice detail, cockpits and boarding, the rear door the caravel had, its own built-in ladder, steps rather, which was really handy for the aircraft. So he sent them over to me, and I spent a very pleasant morning Googling all of the serial numbers I could see in the pictures to get a bit of history on the aircraft so I could caption them. But there was nothing on these two aircraft in the middle of nowhere. So I sent Paul an email and said, listen, mate, I've captioned everything apart from these two. I can't see anything. And about a couple of hours later, I got an email back because he's in the States, so the time difference and all of that. And he sent me a link and I clicked on them. And these two aircraft are in Mexico. And do you know what they do?
What?
They guard the gate of a water park.
I didn't expect that, gotta say. Didn't expect that. I didn't even know. Well, yeah, they did have caravels over stateside, didn't they? Oh, well, I've got to wait for the article, haven't I? I've got to wait for the article. Right, well, let's take a quick break, and after the break, we'll come back for our main feature.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics, and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
This year, it is the 100th anniversary of the crossing of the Atlantic and the 100th anniversary of the airline that would eventually become British Airways. Who better to talk about the dawn of the jet age, VOAC, and progress in transatlantic passenger flight than Captain Hugh Dibley, Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society. Captain Dibley's career spanned piston engine airlines from the Douglas DC-7 to the de Havilland Comet to Boeing 747, right up to Airbus fly-by-wire, as well as an interesting second career as a racing driver in the swinging 60s. It's a real privilege to sit down and talk to him today. Captain Dibley, welcome. What sparked off your interest in aviation in the first place? How did you get interested in flying?
My father was in the Navy, and all I was interested initially was flying in the Navy. Then we moved to the end of runway 36 of Leon the Solent, which was the headquarters of the Fleet Air Arm at the time. So I was weaned on Sea Hornets and Sea Furies and Sea Fires coming over the house, literally almost taking the chimney pots off. So all I wanted to do was fly airplanes in the Navy from the age of about 10 onwards.
Okay. And you learned to fly with the Royal Navy in the 50s then, so...
Well, like many people, I joined the Combined Cadet Force. I started in the Army. I moved to the Naval section. And then to get a flying scholarship, I moved to the RAF section. And what you did was go to Hornchurch to take the RAF pilot's ability. And if you managed to scrape through that, then you could get a flying scholarship, which many of my vintage did, and that gave you 30 hours to get a private pilot's license. So I did 30 hours on a Tiger Moth.
Wow, okay.
At the Royal Naval Flying Club Gosport, which okay. Soon was turned into a hiding estate.
And what happened after that then? So how did you get from the Navy to a sort of civil career?
Well, I wanted to, as I say, fly in the Navy. There, I didn't want to go to Dartmouth, which was the career for the Navy, because you had to leave school at, I think, 13, 14, go to Dartmouth, and then you didn't fly until you were 20 years old. That was very old.
Yeah.
So being a brat, I thought, well, I'll try for National Service or a 4 or 8 year commission. I'll try for National Service because I was concerned that if I didn't make it as a pilot, I might become a looker, an observer.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I just managed to get into the last course, which actually flew in the Navy. Did my basic flying on a piston provost at Syerston. Then the Duncan Sands to Vince Cuts came in and all the RNVRA squadron disbanded. So I then went to the Ark Royal to finish on my national service.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it happened at the Ark Royal, the captain was, who later became an admiral, Frank Hopkins, who we all very much respected. He's one of the few captains, I think, who actually flew an aircraft onto the ship that he was in command of. So he flew a Seahawk, and he knew I was dithering whether to sign on in the Navy. He did say to me, have you thought of civil flying? At the time, I thought, not really. Then when I came out, I looked around. I'd missed going to university. I'd had to sort of do a year, and I thought, well, I'll try to get into BOAC, and if that works, I'll join BOAC. And I was fortunate enough just to scrape into BOAC. I had an interview, and they said, all right, you need to go to AST at Hamble, and we trust them, and if they give you a satisfactory report, then we might take you on. So I did a short commercial course there to convert my military flying into a civil license.
Okay. And what was that training on there then? What was the kind of training?
Basically, that was mainly chipmunks.
Okay.
And it was interesting, quite topical, fairly recently, upset recovery. We did upset recovery. They would put us upside down and say, now recovery on basic instruments. So all that training was part of the scene at that time. And I think I flew an Anson to get the dual.
Yeah.
We had to get a dual engine qualification. But my first type rating on my license was Oster Variants, because you just had to put something on there.
And what was was there a lot of competition to get into BOAC in those days? Well, I mean, you know, getting in at that, getting your foot in the door, was it very, very kind of, was there lots of other people trying to do the same thing then?
I suppose so. My colleague, there were two of us, Midshipman RVR, Ian Hanney was the other one at Syerston. I'd done a flying scholarship, he hadn't, so he had slightly more hours to do. I managed to get into BOAC in September 58, and I think he didn't get his license quite in time or whatever. So he joined BEA the following year, which is very similar, I guess. But I think if you had the right licenses, then you could get in. I know my father-in-law, my sister's father-in-law was an air marshal, and she did say to him, he's thinking of getting to BOAC, what do you think of that? And he said, oh, very good, if he can get in.
And when you started starting as a pilot then?
No, the good thing, which many people didn't like. I thought it was extremely good at the time. You needed straight navigators to navigate in those days. Using Astro, you had no drift ground speed. You had Loran when it was available. The wind forecasts weren't that good. But so you definitely needed flight navigators at that stage. So the policy for BOAC from 1952 on, I think, was they introduced the pilot's initial navigation scheme. So, and bear in mind, I joined in 58. So it had been going for some time. They made the navigators redundant. And so the pilots would navigate for about 3 years. And then they would be given a pilot's course. And this was, I think, very good because it gave them very good grounding on performance, flight planning, and also the route structure because you flew all over the world and you were watching what was going on. So, and I, aged 21, which I was lucky enough to start, thought I wouldn't possibly be qualified to sit in the right-hand seat of a Stratocruiser with some very old captain of 35. Because most of the people were just coming out of the war, of course, and they were in their late 30s, 40s, 50s. We had some Imperial Airways captains who, some of them were a real delight to fly with. One I can think of was Nigel Perry, who was the black sheep of his family. All his brothers were admirals and ambassadors and bishops, but he was a delight to fly with. There's some very lovely captains to fly with in those days, I thought.
Okay. So as a navigator, then your first aircraft was the VOC, was the DC-7, was that?
It was a 7C. You could navigate on the airplane, of course. Yeah. So the first flights I was doing was leaving about 11 o'clock at night, doing London, Prestwick, Gander, Boston, New York, I think. And I didn't know which way was up by the time I got to the other end. But I was just under supervision, helping with with a supervisor. So I did 3 trips on 7Cs, then a couple of trips on Britannia's 312s, which were the long-range Britannia's. Then I was on Britannia 102s, going to, as far as Sydney, going mainly to India, which was not popular with a straight navigator. We never got a look in to go and see South America, because that was still going to the straight navigators.
Wow. Okay.
But then there was mainly an industrial decision when the 707 came in. I should say I ended up on Comets then. So I was navigating on Comets for about a year. Then there was an industrial decision that Balpa wanted 3 pilots on the 707. The company thought only 2 pilots were necessary. So all the 3rd pilots were posted to the 707 as navigators, and all the straight navigators were taken off the 707. So I was on the 707 from 61, 62 until in BOAC 70, or BA 71, yeah, BOAC till 71. In fact, I kept flying it with the Sheikhs in Abu Dhabi till 91, so I actually was on the 7O for 30 years on and off.
Wow, okay. So when you started off on the Navigator, obviously 100 years of transatlantic flight,
yes.
And last week we had a space-based ADS-B come in that was greater visibility across the Atlantic. What was it like when you were starting out on the DC-7 or the Comet being a navigator and navigating your way across the Atlantic and knowing you were out of radio range and what have you, and the radar range you're on your own, basically.
Yes. Well, it was a good job satisfaction, because if you walked off the flight deck, generally speaking, they wouldn't find their way. I mean, we obviously for a while did the Pacific, so doing Tokyo Honolulu, where the winds could be up to 250 knots. Not terribly well forecast, so it would take you a matter of several hours less going eastbound than it did westbound. And westbound, we'd have to go through Wake Island. We couldn't make it non-stop Honolulu. So you were having to use Astro and Loran,
yeah.
And at night, looking at a CRT display, with all the sky waves, you could basically get any reading you liked. So it was more of an art than a science, saying, is my fix right? Was the wind misforecast? And occasionally people did get found themselves on the Atlantic, especially from Bermuda, coming back where the Loran was not good, coming in a bit further south than they thought.
But you were flying, and these are obviously pre-ETOPS days, so you were always flying within range of a diversion.
Well, we're a four-engine airplane, so, yeah. So it wasn't a problem. Having said that, if you can cover that, the big difference between when the jets came is with the reliability on a piston engine aircraft. It was not unusual to have an engine failure, shall we say. You might even say it was unusual not to have an engine failure. And there were several ditchings. People think about Sully being the first ditching. No, there were several ditchings. Pan Am, I think, had a couple, or certainly American operators, to have a runaway prop, where the drag was so high you couldn't go anywhere.
So the Comet, obviously, first transatlantic jet airliner, what was that like to fly in? Obviously more reliable and a better experience for the passengers? What was
it? Well, definitely. I think the big change on the Comet, A, it was a beautiful looking airplane. I think one has to say that. But B, of course, the takeoff performance of a four-engine airplane is not as good as a twin, because basically it all depends on one engine failure, one engine. So a twin, if you have an engine failure, it's half the performance. Well, if on a twin, both engines are going, the takeoff performance is spectacular, as it is now, and everybody's used to that. Now, the Comet was a four-engined jet, but really overpowered.
Yeah.
So really, the performance in a Comet was rather like a twin nowadays. But when you compare that to a Stratocruiser or an Argonaut or Constellation, even a beautiful airplane, lumbering off the ground and flying almost horizontal till it disappeared into the distance, a Comet would go shooting up to, well, over 40,000 feet even. But it was not economic. In fact, when you alight, you save fuel by shutting down an engine or two, which not many people did, but it was said that Alabaster, the flight manager, used to, if you're really scratching for range, they would shut down an engine.
But obviously, if you're going faster, then extra pressure on the navigators to do quicker fixes.
Yes. And we were using Astro navigation through the roof. And you had to pre-compute. Basically, what you did, you would pre-compute the position or the angle of three stars, plot that on a chart. Then you would take the actual angle of the star through the sextant, which you took 2 minutes to take.
Yeah.
And then you would plot the difference between where you thought the angle should be and what it actually was. So it took about 15 minutes to do an astro fix. I occasionally attempted to do 20-minute astro, so it meant to say you were working all the time.
Wow. Okay.
And it was interesting. When I first flew in the right-hand seat as a co-pilot on the Atlantic on a 707, got to the other end, I feel much... quite less tired now, because as a flight nav, you were really working all the time.
Wow, okay. In those days, we tend to think about the jet age as inevitable. It's something that was going to happen anyway. Is that correct? Or were some of the airlines nervous about newfangled jets and we've got super constellations and especially obviously with the Comet crashes. Were they all in favour of jets, or did some of them...
Well, I think BOAC was actually introduced the Britannia, as you probably know. They had the Brabazon, which really was a non-starter. And then de Havilland persuaded them to bring in the Comet, which wasn't economic at that stage. But it really was a vast improvement for the passengers, because you're above all the weather, it was smooth and... a bit noisy outside, but inside it was superb. So the improvement in the passengers was magnificent. But sadly, the Comet was too small. The Comet 4, and that was introduced in 1958. But as you know, BOAC managed to beat Pan Am across the Atlantic, because Pan Am had assumed that they would be the first jet airliner across the Atlantic, and publicized, I think, on the 26th of October, they would operate New York, Rome, or whatever. And BOAC, who had been flying some trial flights across the Atlantic, suddenly got permission to operate in New York, I think at the end of, if I got it right, the end of September. The next day, they said, right, we're going to operate. And so they operated, and they had to go via Gander on the westbound, but they would go direct eastbound. But again, that transformed... flying for passengers.
Yeah.
But the 7-0 was a different league, partly because, you know, the policy was to go for the engines under the wing, which structurally was better, and it was obviously carried twice as many passengers, and the range was much better. So that's why BOAC ordered 707-436s, which in fact was my first pilot's license. But getting back to your first question, BOAC was dithering whether the jets or the props would be good, so they had ordered a Britannia, but in due course the jets proved to be favourable.
Okay, what about the early the back of the aircraft and the cabin and people getting dressed up for the flight? Did that happen? You know, people sort of turning.
Well, initially, mainly people were flying first class. I mean, in the days of when they first started in the 1919s and things, you could see from the food they carried that it was grouse and stuff, that it was all first class service. Then, in fact, when I think the initial BOAC Comet 1s were mainly first class. On the Comet 4, economy was being introduced, and then I think the BOAC generally introduced the Apex fares. I think they were the. It was all controlled by IATA, which many people complained about.
Okay.
That was a cartel, they said. And BOAC actually introduced the idea of having advanced passenger excursion fares or something. I've probably got the name wrong, but you bought the fares in advance.
Yeah.
And therefore it would be cheaper.
Okay.
And Rod Muddle, who was one of the economists brought in by BOAC to look at the fare structure, he said at an IATA conference, they proposed this. Everybody said, no, we don't like that. Then they said, well, if you think of a better idea. And so then everybody adopted it. So cheaper fares started to come in, but mainly people were looking at first-class service, I guess, as the real elite.
Okay. So how many years then were you on were you 3 years on the Comet as navigator, and then you went to...
No, I did one year as a Comet navigator.
Yep.
Then I went to the 7-0s and flew exclusively as a navigator probably for a year. Then I was given the pilot's course. In those days, the simulators were not very advanced, so we were having to do most of the training on the airplane.
Oh, wow, okay.
And the 707-436, as it was, had Rolls-Royce engines, more powerful than the Pratt & Whitney's in the American version. Also, the thrust was instantaneous, shall we say. If you, on training on takeoff, when you brought the outboard engine back to idle, the thrust was gone very quickly. If you didn't get the rudder in instantaneously, you could lose control of the airplane, which some companies discovered fairly late on when they got hold of the airplane. But I hand it to BOAC that they trained a lot of people like myself who had pretty low hours.
Yeah.
You know, probably piloting hours. I had 300 hours, something like that, when I went on the 7-0. I probably had 1,500 navigating hours, so I was aware of what was going on.
Yeah.
But we did not lose any in from the time that I was in BOAC. We didn't lose any airplanes from crew, shall we say, mismanagement, really. Because the policy then was, which was introduced in about 1960, was that a co-pilot should be trained to the same standard as a captain, so he should be able to monitor what the captain was doing.
Right.
And we should have fly leg and leg about, and if the co-pilot was flying the leg, he should make all the decisions, decide the fuel, and if we were down the route, if it was the co-pilot's sector, the station staff who had to do the flight plan, because there were no computers in those days, they would ring up the co-pilot and say, right, what's your fuel? Here's the weather, what's your fuel? To make sure the co-pilot was equally capable as the captain.
Okay. Talking about the kind of cockpit management and things like that, it's obviously pre-CRM and the things about cockpit gradients. You mentioned earlier, some of the captains would be Imperial Airways, or may have flown Lancasters in World War II.
Well, yes, they were.
Was there a big difference in seniority, and also for co-pilots, was it generally a case of shut up and keep quiet and learn?
Well, as I was saying, the OAC brought that policy in from about 1960.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Jack Nicol, who was flight manager training at the time and went on to be in charge of the Oxford Training School. He said, in 1960 in BOAC, we realised had too many accidents because the co-pilots were underqualified and they weren't good at monitoring the captain. Therefore, as I just said, we will give them a part one. At those stage, you could have a part one or a part two rating on your licence for your type rating for your aircraft. And they gave us all type one ratings, which is the same as a captain. So the idea is we should be trained to the same standard as the captain. And it took a bit of time, but it was similar to introducing checklists.
Yeah.
You may require on a different subject, Douglas Bader. One of his accidents, because he didn't use checklists and took off in coarse pitch on his aeroplane and went off the end of the runway. So, and I know talking to one of the, he was ex-military pilots who was then a training captain on Stratocruisers. And he taxied out with a Imperial Airways captain. Bear in mind, he was a sort of junior training captain. And the Imperial Airways captain, from what I remember of him saying, oh, I don't use checklists. So it was Tom Nesbitt, just said, I have control. Taxied back to the ramp and shut down. He said, if you don't use checklists, you have no place in BOAC.
Wow, okay.
And it was a longer, should we say, and also they emphasised you've got to give flying to the co-pilots. They are there to assist you. That was the policy in Boeing. And I remember doing my early trips on Britannia 102 with a very mature, must have been ex-Imperial Airways captain, maybe he was ex, but the co-pilot was basically first officer, was instructing him all the time. So it was accepted and I remember sometimes in fairly jocular ways, a good friend was going into Idlewild, as it then was, and one of the more excitable ex-senior captains was, when the Kennedy said, have you got the field in sight? He said, tell him I've got the field, tell him I've got the field. And the co-pilot just started getting out of his seat. And going, where are you going? He said, if you're going to land there, I'm not going to be sitting beside you when you do. That's Navy New York. So I think there was a good repartee between the co-pilots and the captains, yeah. Although it's fair to say there were some very senior captains who were not particularly approachable. Yeah. But I found that they were fairly rare. But that was my finding.
Were you assigned the same crew? Or was it?
No, absolutely not.
No.
But it's interesting, though, that there were various different airlines, of course, one might say, because there were the Atlantic Barons.
Okay.
Who were flying across the Atlantic, of course, in the Stratocruisers and all these things. The big difference was they were paid allowances in dollars.
Ah, okay.
Rather than getting meal allowances. Now, those of us going to the Far East, you just stayed at hotel and you got full board. So nobody, so it was very different.
Okay.
And then when the 7-0 came along, of course, it enveloped all these routes. And in BOAC then decided we would have three routes. We would have the North Atlantic, where, of course, all the Barons stayed on. And I'd forgotten the second one was probably South America. And we junior people ended up going to Africa and the Far East. And, of course, frankly, going to Africa was, in a way, far more of a challenge.
Yeah.
Because there were no aids, no ATC, very little information. You could be going quite often. You took off without any forecast, because it just wasn't available. And then you had to plan to go somewhere else and hope you got all the information you've got airborne. When you got to the other end, very basic age, probably just NDBs, no ILS.
Yeah.
So that was a great challenge. And again, I thought we're bound to have a little incident here or there. We did not.
Oh. Well, in the pre-computer, pre-electronic scheduling databases and diaries and calendars, what was rostering like in those days? Did you get any say over which routes you could fly, or was it a case of buffing up the chief pilot and saying, I'd like to join the transatlantic barons?
Well, I think that was probably, I think which route you went on was probably done on seniority, you know, the dreaded seniority.
Yeah.
I know, I think my seniority was 1,028 for years. But the rostering was done basically by scheduling staff. Gordon Tucker was in charge, but there were a series of women. And yes, it was a question of chatting up the women. Because then when I was motor racing, I was trying to get back for weekends. So I would sort of agree to go on the worst routes. So I spent a lot of time sitting in Kano in Africa, which nobody wanted to go there during the week because it was, you know, give time off at weekends. But then that was not something I'm particularly proud of. There was a big BOAC pilots dispute, of which First Officer Tebbit was involved. That's Norman Tebbit, who I flew with on 707s, of course. The pilots wanted to go to a computerized bidding system for trips.
Okay.
And the company were resisting that because initially they had done their best and they had a very good system called Platoros, because initially you couldn't schedule anything. So they would say, right, we will give you, you will work for 3 weeks, you may be doing anything in that period, and you will have a week off, but that will be forecast throughout the year.
Yeah.
And they felt that was as good a system as you could. And in fact, in many ways, it was. It probably wasn't terribly efficient on crews. But they had, most people were on this Platoros system, and I personally just was on a random system all the time, which suited me personally. I needed some people to do that. But then, as I say, we came in with a bedline computerized system where you've got to be a good mathematician, an expert in the rules to get the right chips you can. The people who do that engineer it very, very well.
So going back to the airlines, what was your favourite route or least favourite route from the early days then? In terms of
well, I think the favourite airport to fly into was Hong Kong, without a doubt. It's I was born in Hong Kong purely because my dad was a sailor. He was in the Royal Navy. He was captain of the dockyard. He was an engineer, and so I came back when I was 2 years old. So I vaguely remember it, but I started going to Hong Kong fairly early on, and always found that an interesting place to fly into because you had the curved approach. I think that airport was built by the French, which people probably wouldn't like to remind you of. And then, of course, once you got on the ground, it was a pretty interesting place, you would say. But generally, go anywhere, because it was all interesting from the flying point of view, the way air traffic control was organised. My early days was on the North Atlantic on 7-0s, going to New York, Boston, Detroit, Baltimore. We were going to a lot of places then.
Yeah.
San Francisco, Honolulu. In fact, you could. You were saying, "Did I ever think of giving up motor racing?" Giving up flying for motor racing. And I started and didn't finish it. When I was out on the West Coast, a number of psychologists wanted to interview racing drivers. Because they'd been interviewing other sportsmen like golfers and football players to see how their personalities varied. And I think it was the Myers-Briggs thing, which was in 64. I remember filling this thing out when I was in Honolulu, taking ages, you know. and I'm sure Jackie Stewart did his, because Jackie's that sort of person, he would follow through on that. I don't know how many other people did it, but I then went on my next trip, because I was flying through there quite regularly at the time. They analysed me, and they gave my results, and they just said, you are totally different to all the other competitors, because you lack raw aggression.
Oh.
He said, your personality is more like a psychologist, because you're thinking of other people most of the time. I was quite happy. And in fact, a subject we probably shouldn't get onto, but I started a small company building racing cars, because the bloke at Brabham said he could build a car, and if he built it, would I put an engine in it and drive it?
Yeah.
And I said yes, and then we did that, and he actually produced the car. A friend of mine in the States said he could sell it, so we were selling them. But somebody came up to me, or just made the comment, he said, the trouble is with Dibley running his racing car company is he's too soft, because if somebody walks in the door, he actually wants to help them. If it's Chapman, he wants to screw every single penny out of them. But my first wife, who was American, came down to Brands with me and saw that I won, and Sterling was there, obviously Jackie and Jim were there. Yeah. And he thought, oh, that's pretty easy, just got in and get in the car and win. But then when we got married and she realised how much, you know, time it involved,
yeah,
and she said, I hadn't got time for her. And I said, all right, I'll give up racing. She said, no, I don't want to marry to an airline pilot.
What was your least favourite route then? So Hong Kong, Kai Tak was the favourite airport. Did you have a least favourite route? You said, oh, no, not going, do I have to go to there? Or was there any places that, I mean...
Well, I suppose going to Africa was not the best. It depended what place you were going to. I tended to say it was all part of life's experience.
But because of the lack of nav aids and the ATC.
And of course, you got in hotels with no air conditioning, no anything. Because in those days, yeah, the hotels were extremely basic. If you're going to, we used to go to Karachi and stay in a Speedbird rest house, which was, again, very basic stuff. I think one just took it in one stride.
And what about, so how long were you on 707s? Because the next one after that is 747, or did you go to the...
No, I went to 747. Where did I go on what, sorry?
It was 747 after...
Yeah, I was actually posted to the 747 in 1969 as a navigator, because what I did in the mid-60s, all the pilots were navigating, and they had to be checked every year. So we had about five pilot navigators who were in the office doing checks on the pilots as they come through. We would analyze it, each chart. You know, the charts had to be, you know, had to be filed, and we would just look at the charts to see if people didn't get lost. And then we would give them a check once a year, give them performance checks or whatever. So I, in fact, was posted to the 747 to be in charge of the navigation if the INS did not work.
Oh, okay.
Because INS was totally new. I mean, it was in development stages, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But it was the same system that took the astronauts to the moon. So you might say BOAC was being ultra cautious. The first three 747s had sextants in case the INS didn't work,
yeah,
which it obviously did. And we had Loran fitted to the first, that's a, you know, electronic navigation aid with a CRT, that was fitted to the first six aircraft, which we never ever used, because the INS turned out to be very reliable.
Yeah.
On the seven, yeah, and so I was put on it and I was meant to instruct the crews on the INS, but in the end it was so relatively simple, it was taken over by the normal conversion course.
Yeah.
And I then became a pilot instructor on the simulator, so I was actually a type rating examiner.
Okay.
On the 747 from 1971.
Wow. Okay, so just at the start of, I mean, it only came to service with BOAC in
71. Should have been 70.
Yeah.
But due to the discussion with the pilots, we didn't start until, didn't get agreement with the pilots. I don't think anybody was that worried, because the engine reliability was dreadful in the first year, and I think BOAC made more money selling the engines to other operators so they weren't too fussed that they didn't have an agreement. But then it was a good interesting time for the crews, because, well, these weren't necessarily on the aeroplane, you know, in flight, I should say, but one stage I remember in the 73-ish, we were having six unscheduled engine changes per week on the fleet.
Wow. So what was your impressions of, I mean, now we look back, it's 50 years of the 747 this year, we've got another anniversary.
Yeah.
Did you get the impression at the time that this is the big leap forward, or was it, this is just a bigger 707, this is just slightly bigger, and it's got, you know, double decks. You know,
I think because
was there that kind of feeling that this is really the future of aviation?
I think because there were so many passengers, then although obviously it was not in the commercial world, part of the policy in BOAC is that all the we all were in one building at Heathrow, and in the management dining room, you had to sit down with somebody else from your, not from your own department, but somebody from another department. So you should learn what was going on in the rest of the airline. So I tried to keep up with the commercial side. And of course, the airplane was becoming more of a sort of wholesaler, you know, therefore, I think that was the difference, that they, therefore the fares were dropping considerably. Still obviously had first class, and you had the upper deck, which was a lounge, which didn't last long,
yeah,
because it was soon filled up with people. But the other thing which really impressed me about the 747, the 707, we had our freighters. They used to fly the 707 freighter. That would carry 40 tons of freight. But the 74 could also carry 40 tons of freight. So regardless of the passengers, you could be carrying a 707 cargo load, which made them very attractive commercially. In fact, one of the reasons I understood that the President of Emirates was not terribly happy with the A380 to begin with was because the cargo load on the A380 is not as good as the Boeings.
Okay. When you... You know, you talked about sort of being a sort of a pilot navigator initially, INS being reliable, and your career has taken in multi-crew pilot, co-pilot, navigator, flight engineer,
yeah,
radio operator, maybe. From multi-crew to three crew and then two crew. How has that sort of transformed the industry? And do you think airliners could ever fly single pilot?
Sure. Well, as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of development going on in that area. I'm a member of the Académie de l'Air L'Espace based in Toulouse, and Alain Garcia has done a study showing what needs to be done to go from two crew to one crew to no crew. But their conclusion was that it's not going to happen now. So, I mean, it could happen, I guess. But I think we just have to take it in very slow stages. I think the next stage may be is to have a single pilot in the crews.
Yeah.
Now, in BOAC, you had two pilots and a flight engineer, but we always needed two crew in the crews. We didn't. You know, one person could snooze quite happily because there was always two other people,
yeah,
there to watch. When it comes to a two crew operation, obviously, on the longer sectors, you must carry three pilots. So the saving on long haul was not that great on the piloting side, you might say. I think the important thing, I still think, is that it is crew monitoring between the two, which, as I have to say, BOAC did endeavour to introduce in 1960. There was great talk about CRM coming in what, 1990-ish?
Yeah,
but... the policy was in BOAC that both crews should be capable of monitoring each other,
yeah,
from that way on.
Okay. And so from the 747, you went on to the TriStar, is that right? Or?
Yes, we re-merged with BEA in 1974. So initially, it was BEA was split off from BOAC in 1946. Then in the early 70s, politically, it was decided to have a holding board with a possibility of the re-merger. I think it's fair to be, BEA was not making money.
Yeah.
So, and BOAC did make money from the time that Giles Guthrie came in, from 63, 64 to 77. Except, I think, in 70, when the 747s weren't flying. So I don't think that was too good a year. But the rest of the time, Boeing made money. Anyhow, it was decided to re-merge BOAC-BEA. So initially from 74 it became BAOD and BAED, operating under separate,
yeah,
operator certificates. And BEA had ordered 12 TriStars, which they couldn't operate efficiently. Their utilization was 3.5 hours a day, whereas you should be operating at least eight hours a day. I mean, even the short-haul operators now are operating up 15 hours a day, I think.
Yeah.
So the British Airways board decided to give two of the TriStars to overseas division to operate to the Gulf. I, in fact, got my command direct on the 747. I became a first, just a seat switch in 75. So I became a 747 captain when I was, in fact, 37, 38. So I spent a long time as a co-pilot, but I went straight as a captain on 74. So I was not quite happy with that.
Yeah.
And I'd been a training co-pilot, I became a training captain again within 2 months. So I was very happy there. Being a training captain at the bottom of the seniority list, which if you're a training captain, the bidding system, you're aside from the bidding system.
Yeah, okay.
But then as the TriStar was being operated by BOAC, BEA's grid, and he was being operated by OD, but of course the BEA people were saying, well, it's our aeroplane, so our crew should fly it. And industrially, it was decided to have half BOAC, half BEA pilots, with a flight engineer, but operated to BOAC's procedures.
Okay.
BEAs were different to other people's, to everybody else. So basically we looked at those and said, no, we'll use our own and use Lockheed manuals, because some of the manuals that BEA used, like the minimum equipment list, we could not use because they didn't comply with the manufacturer's
some people in the US, for example, talk about recent US airline yeah. mergers and say, you know, they're still recovering from
all sorts of them.
You know, the big mergers there, and there's a difference. What was the corporate culture then of this merger coming from BOAC and BEA there? Can you sort of talk around that a little bit? I mean, from my perspective, from here, it sort of seems, well, you know, you've got the glamorous BOAC and a little bit more pedestrian kind of, you know, bus drivers.
We have to be the same, of course, but there
BEA, is that fair?
That was up to BEA. Always had a slightly jaundiced view of BOAC, and the fact was, you know, when I joined BOAC for various reasons, when I left the Navy. I'll tell it as it is. They just had the Manchester United accident at Munich, which is very sad. And of course, we all have accidents. But the way it was handled was a bit odd. The captain was fired for sitting in the wrong seat. Mm. Then Lord Douglas of Kirkleside said that they were having some industrial trouble. He said, "Well, all BEA pilots." Are a bunch of sergeant pilots, which I thought was a little odd. And then more commercially, you've got to make money. And BEA was losing money, so they said, oh, we're going to take sweets and papers, newspapers off the aircraft to save money. And I thought, you don't do that because that's affecting the passengers. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem quite right.
Mm.
And it seemed very introspective. So I thought, well, I'll try for BOAC, and I got in. I thought, at least BOAC, you're flying and competing internationally.
Yeah.
You're operating other people's aeroplanes, you know, which everybody else is doing. So that's what attracted me to BOAC. And the fact was, whenever I met a BEA pilot, he would say, oh, long-haul flying's boring, you know, it's awful flying. So, well, it's a matter of choice. But it then turned out, when we re-merged the managers, I was with a management person with BEA I knew quite well, who said, and I said, well, such is the venom. I've always been met with by BEA pilots or people. As soon as they realise I'm BOAC, it was far worse than the Navy and in the Air Force. There's always a friendly rivalry between the Navy and the Air Force pilots. I said, the policy must have come from the top.
Yeah.
And this person looked at me as a complete fool. He said, of course it did. When BEA was split off from BOAC, they knew if they kept it similar to BOAC and it was easy to remerge, they would lose status. So whatever BOAC did, they would do it differently and they would slag them off at every opportunity. So it was an interesting period, shall we say, to go through. And as I say, on the TriStar, we were trying to get them both to work together. And I think we did manage that, and I had to explain why we were doing it our way, because in BEA the policy was the captain would take off, the co-pilot would fly the aeroplane, because he was better at flying the aeroplane, flying instrument approaches, and the captain would land it. And I said, no, our policy is you have two blokes in either seat who are both capable of flying the aeroplane equally well.
Yes. So while we're still on the British Airways part of your career, we mentioned one aircraft we haven't mentioned yet, Concorde. So did you ever put in for flying Concorde?
No, well, I wanted to do actually from the 60s was to fly a Concorde. And in 69, when I was posted for 7-4, being a stroppy little so-and-so, I said to my board, well, I really want to go on the Concorde. They hadn't even flown then. And they said, well, you can go on it afterwards if you like. But I just got, as I say, in 75, I got my command on the 747. And once you couldn't switch to the Concorde. However, I was very close to the Concorde people. And I shared an office with the Concorde manager when I was a flight manager. And very early on, old Keith Myers, who was the training manager, you know, had me on the aeroplane trying to fly it at 60,000 feet. So I had great interest and admiration for the Concorde.
Yeah.
And I flew on the Concorde as commercially when I was with the Gulf, because I went to the Gulf flying for the Arabs, and they would give you first class tickets. So I actually, when I was going to Denver, flew on the Concorde commercially.
Wow, okay.
But then in BA, management pilots had to do three engine ferries at that stage. If an engine was, I had a call at 6 o'clock in the morning saying, well, there's an aircraft stuck in New York. We need you to three engine ferry it back. You can go out to Concorde. When are you going to come back? And I kind of long story short. So I did two trips when I went on the Concorde out to New York and flew a three-engine ferry back on the 747.
Yes, an engine failure.
And I did say to my friends on Concorde, if I can now fly a 747 back, why can't you fly your little airplane back now instead of going to the hotel? No, it was a superb operation at Concorde.
So moving on from British Airways, you then went on to fly for the Abu Dhabi Gilman VVIP flight, and that was the 747 SP.
747 SP, yes.
Right? So kind of a really rare variant of the jumbo jet.
Well, even more, well, not particularly, well, quite rare, because it had Rolls-Royce engines. It was taken, they started production line out of it. After when the Arabs started the oil, they obviously were getting their own airplanes. Initially, Abu Dhabi and Qatar subcontracted, you might say, wet leased BOAC VC-10s, which were very popular. And they were superb, of course, the VC-10. I didn't go, I would have loved to go on the VC-10, but again, being on 7-0s, I couldn't switch. Then when the VC-10 started fading out, they were getting their own airplanes. They got a 707 in Abu Dhabi. And they wanted BOAC crews. So we would provide the crews from London and we would rotate the crews on a seniority and suitability. Not everybody would go there. So we would pick the people in seniority order. Some people obviously were not, because you had to be extremely flexible for that sort of operation. So they operated a 7-0. And then when they got the 7-4, Denzel Beard, who was in charge, then said to me, would I set up the 747. I said, well, I didn't want to leave BA, so I was in fact seconded so I set up the 747 and then eventually became the acting director operations, which was in charge of the seven airplanes, but also 43 stewardesses, of which 40 were Arabic. And that was not easy to manage, shall we say, because you didn't know what the rules were from day to day. So I did that for a couple of years, anyhow.
Okay. And what are they outfitted like on the inside?
Lufthansa did a very good job on the 707. They had Lufthansa Technique would do the internal. The Americans, they had D. Howard in San Antonio, Texas. So the airplane would be bought from Boeing, flown down to San Antonio and spent years there, I mean, two years probably, being fitted out. They'd actually had gold-plated thrust levers, but that was a bit of a gimmick. But obviously, the whole interior was ripped out, and they would have marshes, just open areas where they could sit down.
Yeah.
They were very proud of having a goat oven. They had an oven which was sufficiently large to take a goat. And the aeroplane would have which was, well, it's usual now, but in those days it was not. It had a satellite, which was a marine satellite, in the bubble. It was which would rotate, taken off a ship, basically.
Wow.
And so they had a large section, which was all communications. Because I should say, initially, getting back to the early days of flying, you were all using high frequency radio, HF.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was very difficult to get through. You'd spend the whole evening shouting and screaming on HF.
And the Morse code? Did you have to know Morse code?
We didn't do Morse. I was just too late for that. We had a radio operator just on the airplanes before I arrived. And the Comet 1,
yeah,
had which I only learned the other day, it had two pilots, a navigator, and a radio operator, because they still needed Morse code. The co-pilot used to pre-compute his astro,
yep,
get out of the seat at top of climb, and take his astro fix,
yep,
and then get back in the seat for the descent. That was getting a bit too cavalier, I think. And on this Comet 4, we didn't have that. We had a proper navigator.
Yeah. And so moving on from the Abu Dhabi kind of royal flight, you then went to Air Hong Kong. So that was a freight airline?
Yes, it was totally freight.
Yeah.
As I say, because the Abu Dhabi operation was superb, because you were flying the head of states. I remember flying all the Abu Dhabi head of states from Abu Dhabi up to Beijing. So it was Sheikh Mohammed, Sheikh Khalifa, of very nice people and very competent people. I mean, Sheikh Mohammed, he had the Dubai Air Wing. He flies on airplanes.
Yeah.
But yes, I then the contract with Abu Dhabi came to an end, and so I then was leaving BOAC, and I got to know Air Hong Kong because they bought 707s. I was still current on the 707 while I was flying the 747, and they needed it put on the Hong Kong register. So while I was on a trip, I think probably with BA, or maybe, you know, I did fly it especially, I did a C of A, you know, certificate of airworthiness for them to accept it onto the Hong Kong register,
yeah,
which was the same as the British register. And then they said to me, oh, we're getting 747s, would you come and join us then? And I thought, well, I'll believe that when it happens. And it did, but they were in big trouble economically. And they were talking about going broke, and a person called Stanley Ho took over the operation. He was about to wind it up. But part of my interest, I didn't really mention this, when I gave up motor racing, I went into fuel conservation, which I found just as interesting, frankly, as driving airplane, cars in circles.
Okay.
Because the airplanes were not being operated very efficiently, and more significantly, coming into Heathrow, the airplanes were being descended down to 2,500 feet. And the fact was that BEA, which was the majority operator coming in here, had a simple procedure. They said, leave the holding fixed, gear down, flap 10, auto thrust in. So they were leaving the holding fix in a very high drag configuration. Didn't matter where the holding fix was.
Yeah.
And I'd flown from Lambon in the east all the way around over Henley and back again for 20 minutes with the gear down on a Trident. On the other hand, I was going over putting the children around Regent's Park Zoo, and you could see that the aircraft coming off Bovington, going on a heading of southeast out over Greenwich and then over London, the BE aircraft coming up with the gear down, so they would descend very quickly, whereas the DC-9s of SAS and KLM would be sort of gliding over. And then, of course, the fact was they'd be then flying at 2,500 feet right over the centre of London. And I lived to the west. And they came over the house, you could not talk.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wrote an article in the Guild of Air Pilots journal saying we should start descending approaches. We shouldn't be sort of diving down to 2,500. We should be actually coming down on a controlled descent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was introduced in 1975.
Oh, okay. So a lot of people in London.
What?
A lot of people in London have you to thank for a quieter life.
Yeah, the people further out. Probably the people in Richmond will never be happy. And Hounslow even. But yes, in fact, the person who initially BEA said, no, we can't do that because we need the thrust for the engines. But then Lufthansa came along a year later and started preaching exactly the same philosophy. And it was picked up by the press, including The Economist and people like that. And then Nats basically said to BEA, you've got to introduce this. And it was introduced in BEA by a lovely man called Frank Dell. And Frank introduced it to BEA, but he very sweetly, when I saw him some years later, he said, well, that was probably my biggest achievement in life. He said, but it was your idea.
Yeah. Now fuel efficiency is the number one thing that airlines worry about.
Well, indeed.
Any fraction you can get. Amazing. So
that was in '73. I started that because, of course, the fuel price went up significantly. Yes.
Oh, okay. So we did time. So from Air Hong Kong, you then went on to Airbus in Toulouse.
Well,
so fly by wire
on the way there, should we say?
Yeah.
What I liked about Air Hong Kong, it was just a straight freight operation. You might say how terrible, but it was really carrying the maximum payload at minimum cost. That was my boss in BOAC, old Jimmy Andrew, had on his desk handwritten notes saying, lest we forget, our job in flight operations is to carry the maximum payload at minimum cost. It was interesting when we re-merged with BEA and the big book of rules came out, payload wasn't even in the index. but anyhow... That was, and so what we did was to try and get the operation more efficient by doing re-clearances and getting the payloads up, which we did. And in fact, Stanley Ho realized that it could actually probably make money. And he was just about to shake his hand with China Southern, with a Captain Hugh of China Southern, when Cathay, who had always been trying to smother Air Hong Kong, realized that they had to make a sensible bid, and it was bought by Cathay. Mm-hmm. So at that stage, I should have become the VP. I was the chief pilot. But of course, when you re-merge, all the top there goes.
Yeah, yeah.
But coincidentally, at the top, which I didn't mention, when I went back to 707 as the manager, we were operating 11 airplanes outside BA. Even though BO was not operating 7-0s, we had a little Dibley's Air Force, they called it. And one of them was the Air Mauritius schedule operation. And we operated their 707 for them. And in fact, getting back to fuel conservation, we actually, in fuel over Air India, saved them more fuel than the cost of the cruise.
Wow.
Because they agreed that we'd save them about 13%. And the cost of the cruise were $2 million. Dollars a year, and so the crews, which were only costing were less than $200,000 a year, so that was always been my interest, really.
Yeah.
So Air Mauritius then asked me to go back as the director of operations. Initially they'd said, when I was in Abu Dhabi, would you like to come back, it's a non-flying job. I said no, thank you. And they said, oh, we're getting A340s, so we'll give you an A340 course. So I joined Air Mauritius, were given an A340 course, then was introduced to Airbus.
Yeah.
And I was with Air Mauritius for a year. Like a good friend of mine who was in Air 2000, the human resources people felt they ran the airline. And I clashed with them slightly, so decided to leave. Well, and Airbus, because I got to know Airbus, and then Airbus said, well, come and work for us.
What was the was it a big culture shock then to come from the Boeing culture or the Lockheed culture or even de Havilland side sticks, fly by wire?
No, I think that's grossly overdone, frankly.
Yeah,
grossly overdone. And I would say another thing is that I thought I'd done quite a good job going from a 747 Classic without flight management. We had flight management on 747 in BA to an A340, and I thought it was a great achievement. But then when I was working for Airbus and checking pilots, Chinese pilots, I remember checking a Chinese captain who had gone from Tupolev 142s to an A340, not speaking one word of English. I thought, well, that's a pretty good achievement. And I mean, signed him out. He knew what he was doing. And I flew into China on delivery flights with Chinese crews. And I mean, they seem to be operating quite well, do they not, in China? So, yes, I mean, they're all aircraft. And I know there are people who are very pro Boeing and saying, you know, Boeing allows the crew to control the airplane. I know the comment was that a Boeing is an aircraft you can fly manually and also automatically.
Yeah.
An Airbus, you fly automatically, but you can't fly manually.
Yeah.
But you have to fly both of them manually. And the fact is with Airbus, you have to understand the systems. The important thing is to understand the systems.
Yeah. Okay. And what was your of the types you've flown, what was your favourite aircraft of them all?
I mean, I would have to say my days on the 747 were very happy days. This was in the 70s.
Yeah.
When it was still, BOAC was still a respected airline, shall we say. And we were operating out to Sydney, in the east, and all over the place. And it was a big step. The 74 was a big step because we went to INS navigation, of course. Obviously, flight management came along later on. And everybody loved the TriStar, I think, as you probably said, you've heard. And Lockheed were well ahead of the industry. When I was on the TriStar, which we didn't mention this, but I was, when we re-merged with BEA, I was actually helping define the TriStar 500, the Lockheed long, wow. The long-range version, and putting an FMS, the first FMS was going to go on that. And so, and in fact, they did a 4D flight, you know, landing on a specific time on the TriStar in about 77, I think.
Wow. Okay.
And I was mentioning that to Airbus when they were saying how clever they'd just done a full flight. So, I mean, the Lockheed was a lovely airplane.
Yeah.
Okay. But I guess old Fat Albert, because of the crew structure. It's interesting, most of the airline crews will go for the route rather than the aircraft.
Really?
Yeah, I think you'll find now most pilots in a long range, especially a long range aircraft operation.
I mean, so you've been your career has obviously spanned, you know, such a wide variety of aircraft and the new technology that comes in, FMS and fly-by-wire and side sticks. And what do you think was the biggest leap in aviation safety that you've seen over since the dawn of the jet age? Anything you could point to say, wow, that really was a game changer. You know,
well,
like
would you believe
TCAS?
TCAS certainly probably saved the operation over Africa, I guess, because initially flying down to Africa, nobody would know where you are. The air traffic control was appalling, but there wasn't much traffic. Then after apartheid, of course, the traffic came up and always felt extreme. But I, perhaps ironically, I would say DME, distance measuring equipment, which came in the late 60s. Because before that, you just didn't know where you were.
Yeah.
Now, as soon as the DME came in, the distance measuring equipment, which was a hike, you knew how far you had to go to land or to wherever you're going. Therefore, you could immediately start computing what height you should be at. Most people just multiply by 3.
Yeah.
And in fact, I didn't mention that. The Americans were used it going into the States a lot. They would give you a clearance based on DME. And they would say you'd descend to 11,000 cross 60 DME at 15,000 or below. And you could work that out. Now, that's difficult to work out in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have to look at the DME, subtract 60, multiply by 3, and add 15,000. And I defy anybody to do that in their head. So I came up with a little circular slide rule. But it also meant to say that you can actually do non-precision approaches just with a table.
Yeah.
I mean, I had it with a little circular slide rule, which would just give you the distance you should be at and the altitude you should be at on the approach. And that's what I didn't mention, is that when part of the descending approach is into Heathrow, My suggestion was we should put DME on the runway, which wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
And as it was not necessary for ATC, ATC wouldn't pay for it. But the Department of Transport, I think it was, who was responsible for noise, they paid for the DME. That was in 1975.
Oh.
My whole argument was that once you got the distance, then you could start doing gliding approaches.
Yeah.
Without knowing how far you were out. And we had some silly accidents. TWA had one in going to Washington where the person ended up 2,500 feet, 20 or 30 miles from the field. Now, you multiply by three, you should be 9,000 feet.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, ironically, I would say one of the things. Then you've got, obviously, you're going to say INS and TIP, but that was a large safety improvement. There were a lot of accidents. The highest cause of accidents was non-position approaches, where people didn't know where they were and they would land short of the field.
Yeah.
If they used DME properly and it could be in front of you or behind you, then you could do a constant angle non-position approach.
Yeah. Okay. What about mentioning accidents? What was your have you had any hairiest near misses or close calls that you've
I would say that probably you might say the most dramatic was an engine fire out of Perth, where the first officer flying it, old Don Mitchell, was flying it, and just as I picked the gear up, the fire warning went off.
And what aircraft was it?
747.
747.
It was in 1983, and there was a smell of burning, and so it was obviously a fire. And I remember Don was flying it, so he just said, all right, engine fire drill, number one engine. And we'd actually, in BOAC, we were three crew, of course, we shut the engine down probably by 200-300 feet, climbed away, and by doing the drill, you fire off two fire bottles. But the warning light stayed on.
Oh.
And so you then wound it up to 280 knots, to try and blow it out, still. The fire warning light was on. I looked out of the window, pitch black night. I said, well, I can't see anything, it's number one engine. So we spoke to the cabin crew in charge and said, did you notice anything down there? I said, yes, there was flames from that engine or sparks, and that's now stopped. The smell of smoke had gone. So I remember saying to Don, what do you want to do, Don? Go on to Bombay on three engines. So he said, nope. Dump fuel and go back. So this is what we did. And just the three of us, you know, we were happy to go back.
Yeah.
And we landed back at obviously max landing weight. And that was the end of it, basically. But the warning light went out when they changed the engine. Now, I always said, if that had been an ECAM airplane, if that had been an Airbus, the ECAM would have told you to land back on the runway over max weight. You probably would have blown all the fusible plugs, so the tire, you know, wheels might have caught fire, and then evacuate people on the runway. So we would have had 375 people out on the runway. And I said, we used our, and only one CAA man said, oh, no, fire line was on, you should have gone back. I said, we used our extra sense of smell. But the other one, if you want to know the closest, probably, was on the TriStar, which had not a spectacular climb performance. And it was very unfair to air traffic control because we were operating VC-10s and TriStars alternate days. We asked for climb clearance from 35 to 39,000, roughly over Sofia. We were coming up from Istanbul up, and we were staggering up at a very low rate of climb. And I saw a 747 coming the other way. I couldn't see a 747, just a trail. And I looked at this thing, and it turned in towards us. We were going through 37,000 feet, and it was just coming straight towards us. So I took the autopilot out. No, I didn't. I used the turn knob.
Yeah.
So I took the autopilot and turned it. Went down the side. I remember calling up ATC and said, "What was the call sign of that Aeronair 747? We got the registration. We didn't get the call sign." The coincident was an Iranian who worked for Airbus. Now he told a good story, mind you. I told him that story. He said, I was the first officer on that 747. Now, whether that was true or not, I don't know. But that was probably the closest. But it also said that you needed to look out. Not everybody said, oh, you don't need to look out.
There's nothing that occurs to me, obviously, you know, flying around the world in those days with limited navigation than what we have today is I mean, large parts of the world would be off limits and you know, due to the Cold War, you had the barriers up and you had obviously
the places you couldn't fly over.
Yeah. I mean, did you have any sort of instance there where you were flying to Moscow and we deviated off track here? And
no,
and MiGs are up to kind of meet us.
No, we did have a 707, which got. It was at the time of was it Gorbachev or not? It was the Russians were coming to see the Brits, you know, at a high level, and going from Delhi to Tehran, again the winds could be quite strong. I remember doing 20-minute Astro on a comet, and I took this fix after 20 minutes, leaving a VOR, and we were 30 miles south of track, and I thought, well, have I made a mistake? I'm glad to say it wasn't 60 miles south of track, because I would immediately thought I'd use the wrong latitude and start working everything out again. But basically, it was just the wind was forecast incorrectly. And there was a 707 where then they found that the wind was forecast northwesterly, and it was southwesterly. Mm-hmm. And they got up too far north, and they ended up, and apparently the Russians had picked that up.
Oh, okay.
But we in the nav office had picked it up, and sort of looked at it, mainly because one of the friends, a girlfriend, was a steward. They said, oh, we lost 20 minutes going into Tehran the other day. So we thought, well, what happened to that one? So we were prepared with the answer.
Okay, I think we're about just to wrap it up here. Let's finish off with your thoughts on the future of airlines, the future of civil aviation. What do you think? You know, having seen this progressive technology and navigation and safety, what do you think will be the next big leap for civil aviation? Do you think supersonic flight might come back one day? Or,
well, I think that's, in fact, the Academy to Learn Less Pass. Just produced a paper or discussion, which funnily enough I could have brought, but I haven't. I could give it to you. Where they feel, no, it's not going to happen. They're talking about building it for smaller aircraft, but they're not going to be economic. That's the feeling. And of course, it depends if you're talking about the environment and the ecology. They are grossly more inefficient and producing more carbon and all the various emissions. So the Academy de Leon, I should say, who've just looked at it and they feel no, that the current ones are going to be very difficult. There might be some small supersonic VIP aircraft, perhaps, but nothing of any substantial size, it's not thought. But, as you know, there's always been talk of flying wings and things like that. Are they going to come along? Some people say yes, some people say no. I should say, of course, that the big advantage of flying around now is the aids, you know, with GPS approaches. So where you don't have to do visual approaches. Having said that, my feeling always is that the most efficient approach is a visual approach. Once you can see the runway and fly it, in fact, I could say I was going into Heathrow downwind on a 747, and at the same time as a Concorde was going off, and because the Concorde had a fixed route. They would fly over Greenwich and they would put it into the INS system, so they'd always fly that route.
Yeah.
And I remember looking down to see the runway there and just say, calling up Heathrow and saying, can I do a visual approach? And they said, yeah, help yourself. So I just turned in and they actually said, oh, you better back off because you're cacking out the Concorde. So he turns inside the Concorde, which just shows that the most efficient approach is when you can fly visually. Otherwise, if you're doing it automatically, you've got to pre-program it. Having said that, people I respect now in the Caribbean, you know, we used to really have good flying, just flying visually around the Caribbean. They were saying people just lose the skill of flying visually, so they tend just to opt for the standard now, you know, GPS approach, where they know the airplane can fly it.
Yeah.
But
do you think hybrid electric aviation for short haul would that make a change in operation? Because there you've talked about kind of fuel management,
noise too. I mean, that's where I'm wondering if you know, there was talk of Boris Island and all that. Will aircraft in due course become sufficiently quiet that they won't make any noise? And you look a bit stupid when you build a Boris Island out. And in fact, maybe Heathrow might be acceptable.
Yeah.
It's going to take some time. I'm sure the idea is to have, rather than two engines being... You have one engine with a generator and lots of electric motors driving propellers. That's probably the next stage, is it not? Yes. Very small aircraft, of course, they might do the electric, be powered electrically. Yeah. But then the other people have been talking about all this time is hydrogen power.
Yeah.
I went to a place in France and a person had built a hydrogen model aircraft. I mean, a fairly big one, but his comment was that the equivalent electrically takes, and I probably got the time exactly, not exactly right, it takes about 2 hours to charge and lasts for half an hour, whereas the hydrogen one takes 10 minutes to charge and lasts for an hour and a half.
Mm.
But again, hydrogen is one of those things that's always people have their ideas about, but it's until you get the generation and storage. Yeah.
Fantastic. Right. Okay. So on that note, unless there's anything I've forgotten.
Well, no, I don't know what you what you want.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Well, it's been fantastic to get you on the record, and many thanks.
Well,
thank you very much.
Pleasure, Tim.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, managing editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. The guys at Extended have kindly given me a couple of minutes to talk about our latest edition, TAH-27, officially published on April the 15th. Our cover story this time is actually a tribute to a remarkable old colleague, but I'll come back to him later. First, we mark Concorde's recent 50th anniversary, but rather than trot out the familiar history, we've got Professor Keith Hayward looking at its early Anglo-French political history. The politics took a decade to sort out. Shades of Brexit. Oh, I said the B word. That's 50 pence in the tin. Secondly, another major article in the issue concerns the Hawker Typhoon. We all know it suffered problems with catastrophic structural failure of the tail, but the fix involved much more than just adding reinforcing plates to the rear fuselage transport joint. Author Richard Seth Smith, who lost his test pilot father Kenneth in one of the accidents, uses contemporary documents and a recently rediscovered letter written by Hawker chief test pilot Philip Lucas to reveal just how complex the investigation and the solution turned out to be. Elsewhere in TAH-27, we explore Qantas' World War II Indian Ocean services using Catalina flying boats, Vought F-4U Corsairs with the Argentinian Navy, Egypt's Hispano-Helwan HA-300 lightweight supersonic jet fighter of 1964, which was designed by none other than Willy Messerschmitt, and a bizarre Jules Verne-esque French single-bladed reaction-propelled waterborne rotary wing experiment built before World War I, the Papin-Rouille Gyroptère. We also reveal newly unearthed details from the FAST Museum at Farnborough of a wildly ambitious British supersonic jet fighter design dating back to the late 1940s, which amazingly had swing wings, swinging tail surfaces, and you could swing the wing and tailplane on each side and back and forth differentially for longitudinal and lateral control. It was bonkers! Finally, coming back to the cover story, we pay tribute to Richard T. Riding, TAH's honorary grandfather, as we call him, who was the founder editor of my old magazine, Aeroplane Monthly, and who died suddenly in January. TAH truly keeps his boisterous spirit alive. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking to Extended.
Tim, absolutely fantastic. Loved that interview. Fascinating character. I think when I first listened to it, it's the second time I've listened to it. When I first listened to it, I just wanted it to just go on forever. I didn't want it to stop. I just wanted it to go on. He's got so much to say, and there's so much more in there. Fascinating character.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Captain Dibley is—he's one of our stalwarts. He's one of the stalwarts of the Toulouse branch, obviously the Airbus connection down there, and he's one of these people who you'll meet at an RAS lecture or RAS conference, and you know, you'll be talking about something and you'll say, "Oh, what about that? What about that?" You know, or you know, did you know so and so? You know, did you know so and so? You know, they had the. You know, and you'll hear kind of a sort of a snippet of a story, and that is interesting, isn't it? And so it was a real privilege and a pleasure to sit down with him and just, you know, fire him at you know, sort of questions at him, and just let him kind of you know, sort of BOAC and the BEA rivalry, yeah. You know.
That was quite fascinating, actually. Why is it that the British industry had so much politics in it? You know, the manufacturers, we sort of were great at inventing things, but then managed to trip ourselves over at every opportunity at being successful.
Yeah, I think there is some some truth in that, you know, of I mean, you know, the classic one up there, it would be you know, VC-10, isn't it, designed for BOAC's BOAC's kind of roots, or Trident, you know, and then you know, the you know, BOAC buying 707s, you know, so yeah, there is an element of that of you know, trying to balance. I think, you know, the governments of the day trying to balance. Well, what does the industry want versus what does the, you know, what does the you know, flag carrier want? And sometimes these are not the two same things. And if you do try and align them, suddenly you find out you've built an aircraft that is too specialized. You know, yeah. You know, and that's the you know, that's the problem we had. You know,
fascinating discussions about navigation. And interestingly, that question you asked him at the end, what was the or towards the end, what was the greatest invention on safety or something? And he said the DME.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
I mean,
I didn't expect that. Really did.
Yeah, but if you think about it, you know, the all of a sudden being able to measure your distance from, you know, a beacon or a station, and you know, you with that information in your head, you know, as long as you do the maths and you work out the you know, rate of descent and stuff, you can find your way anywhere, and you could do approaches, you know. That was really, you know, interesting.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
I could tell, Tim, listening to the interview, how much you were enjoying yourself, even though it was mainly him. And one of the things that immediately came to my mind was one of the things we're doing to commemorate our 10th anniversary on GAR is that all of the guys on the team are picking a favourite feature that's run at some point in the 10 years, and we're going to refresh them image-wise and everything. We're going to republish them. And when I sat down to think about it, I immediately had two or three, not necessarily because of the content, but because of the person that I was interviewing. I know that three of us between us will have interviewed countless people. I'm guessing, Tim, that's got to be up there as one of your best experiences, maybe.
Yeah, I suppose it would be. You know, it's the breadth of, you know, starting out on DC, well, starting out even before that as a sort of, you know, national serviceman and wanting to fly, you know, Sea Furies off a carrier.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you go to DC sixes, you know, and I think at one point he says something about, you know, the flying there, you know, if you, it wasn't a case of if you had a, if you had an engine failure, it was a case of, you know,
when
you know, when you had an engine failure, it was more likely you, you'd get to the, and you know, more unlikely you wouldn't have an engine failure at some point.
And he rattled through the, some of the aircraft types, and I was almost like, whoa, hang on, I want to hear about that one. You know, Britannias, he flew everything, didn't he?
Yeah, and then getting on to the Airbus, you know, A340, you know, being, and he's still, you know, he's still one of those people that, that will, you know, the industry will kind of go to as a sort of training captain, as somebody who's, who's you know, knows the ins and outs of the business, for, you know, that kind of expert advice and that kind of knowledge that he's got, you know, incredible. I mean, we didn't even...
I was just going to say my favourite recollection that he made was about the training captain who was with that senior captain, not training captain, he was, I don't know.
Was this the checklist story?
I don't use checklists. I have control.
Well, I mean, that was another thing, fascinating thing for me is the... you know, he said it was, wasn't particularly much of a problem, but you know, you imagine like a young, if you're a young, co-pilot joining in the 60s, and there's someone there on the flight deck who's, you know, flown Lancasters over the Ruhr and stuff, and you're there as a SPROG officer. But you know, he said that it was actually BOAC that pioneered the, you know, the CRM, the fact that you have you try and equalize the cockpit gradient so that the co-pilot can speak up and things like that, and that kind of dates back quite well. I wasn't aware how far that actually sort of dated back. I thought that, you know, sort of CRM and those sort of kind of soft psychological factors, you know, human factors, were actually more of a recent invention.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks. Absolutely brilliant.
Thanks so much for doing that for us, Tim. Anyway, another quick break, and after the break, we'll have some shout outs and wrap things up. Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet. No other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Nat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, shout outs and mentions. Gareth, we've got one from you first, I think.
Yes, this is Fly Victor, and it's a pretty extraordinary plan. They're building a full Victor cockpit flight simulator. It's on a business park which is near to RAF Cosford, and they're kind of crowdfunding at the moment, and they're hoping to be open by January of next year. And you can actually go on, and there's sort of reduced rates for the experiences, which you can get half an hour, up to 2 hours. But all of that money, if you sort of contribute now, will go into the pot to getting this this plan finished. Full replica cockpit with full display, sort of proper Cold War feel about the whole thing. And the reason I noticed it and wanted to give it a shout out, because there's an image on the homepage of a Victor B1 RAF Cottesmore, and my dad's in the picture.
Yay!
So for anyone that doesn't know, my dad was in one of the last groups to be called up to do national service. He joined the Royal Air Force in 1958, was only supposed to do till 61, but he signed up an extra year and went to Swinderby for a year working on vampires. But he basically spent 3 years as an instrument technician as the Victor was delivered into service. They had rows of them with no engines in for the, didn't tell the media that, but they weren't quite ready. God is far. But yeah, this is brilliant. I love things like this. And I hope, if you'll excuse the pun, it gets off the ground, because I would love to go and have a play in a Victor cockpit for an hour and see how I get on. So yeah, you'll find it at www.fly-victor.uk, and we'll put the link in the show notes as well. But go and check it out.
And thanks to Rod Holmes for highlighting that to us. Rod, good friend of the show, and of course runs the Twitter V-Force Facebook page, Twitter feed, and website. One from me, Amanda Harrison, who's taking the Solo to Darwin route in a 1942 Tiger Moth. Now, the eagle-eared amongst you will know that Amanda was my instructor when I had my Tiger Moth lesson. Episode 17. So 4 or 5 years ago, when we recorded that for you. She's been working on this ever since, and she's undertaking a flight to celebrate and promote women in aviation, women in engineering, and lots of other great causes. Amanda is flying the 9,000 odd miles in about a month. She's well on her way. She just had an engine failure, but she's crossed the first part of the Mediterranean. Looking at her Twitter feed today, she's doing a fantastic job. She's got very, very little support, very, very little financial support. It's being done on a shoestring. So please do go over, and if nothing else, show her some support on probably the hardest stretches she's facing at the moment. She loved to hear from anyone. She's a great lass. And if you remember that exercise, that episode, she was fantastic for us. So do go over and support her on what is a very inspirational journey.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, she's a great lass. She's had some troubles in life since I flew with her, and I think it's fairly well documented. If you go to her webpage, amandajharrison.com, you can follow everything and find out a little bit more about her there. But I think in comparison to other adventures of a similar type, it's take my cap off to her for flying in this Tiger Moth unaided, no chase planes, nothing. So great stuff. Tim, Following on from our Hugh Dibley interview, the Aero Society's got a pretty decent lecture coming up, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, its anniversary is a go-go this year, as we all know. So if your interest is in Alcock and Brown, the centenary of the first transatlantic flight, Concorde, transatlantic flying, Hugh Dibley and sextants peering out of a comet. We've got a century of transatlantic flying, and that's going to be an Aero Society seminar on June 3rd. Further into the future, if you're not interested in things with wings, we've got a lecture on the Apollo moon landings on 27th of June, and that is from Pat Norris, who back in the 60s was working for NASA as a NASA contractor, and he helped map the moon for Neil Armstrong. Wow. And he's a former member of – he's a former chairman of the RAS Space Group, and he's doing a lecture on the Apollo 11 moon landing. You know, he was there at the time. This is going to be great. So I'm really looking forward to that. And it's at RAS HQ as well in London.
Okay, one final shout-out for this show, and it's a big thank you to Cheryl Semple for the heads-up on this one, and that is that last Saturday – an organisation called the Baders Bus Company did the UK's first disabled flying display team. It's been created by the Douglas Bader Foundation and Aerobility, and they had their first public display at Duxford last Saturday. So a massive, massive congratulations to those folks. Seen the pictures, they all look absolutely delighted with themselves. We'll put a link to their Facebook page in the show notes, but thanks Cheryl for that, who is of course very closely linked to Aerobility. So much appreciated, well done. And on that, it's a wrap. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show, and we'd also like to thank Mikoki and his team at the Aviation Historian. If you feel able to leave us some feedback, please do, iTunes or on your podcast player, greatly appreciated. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license. So it's all about how to find us. Tim, where can we find you on social media?
I can be found at RAS Tim R or on Twitter, or you can go and visit the Royal Aeronautical Society website, and that is aerosociety.com.
And Gareth, whereabouts can we find you?
It's Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you'll find everything GART related at globalaviationresource.com. And only took us 10 years, but GART's finally on Instagram as well, so yet another thing to do, but it seems pretty popular, so I thought we should get involved.
Yeah, it actually fits the medium quite well, actually, because of the photography. And I did want to just say, Paul Filmer, you mentioned earlier, what a great photographer he is, and Cole Drake as well. Yeah, great photographers.
We're very lucky.
Yeah, I'm just gonna put my microphone just down to one side because you can find my Bassett sat next to me snoring. He's not on social media, although he does have his own Facebook page. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and on our Facebook page. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth.
Goodbye, see you next time.
And it's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Yeah, Ronnie. That wasn't your fault.
No,
we are only 92 episodes in. We should be relatively good at it by now.
Well, one would think, wouldn't one? Right, okay. Let's get a straight face. I'm trying. I'm desperately trying. I'm competing against LOL dolls at the moment. got my red arrows playing, and we'll have to get you on the show as a guest.
So yeah, I'm quite good. I'm not bad.
That means I can't nick that idea. Damn it.
Bit like having a couple of jumbos by the gates of Alton Towers or something like that.
Yeah. But, apologies in the background. I've got a snoring basset. Hang on a sec.
There's an outtake.
Beagle basset.
I'm just going to put my microphone next to him. Bless him. He's getting very old now. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth.
That's what I said. Tim's nicked my line. Now I don't know what to say.
You say see you next time again. see you next episode.
Okay.
I thought Tim says what I was going to say, and he did.
Right.
Because it's impossible to do. Have you noticed when you have to do a bit again, you never say the same thing, do you?
No.
You always say something different. So actually, maybe Tim will revert to his first shout.
Right, okay. I'll just say goodbye then. Right. Okay.
doesn't matter. I just knew that was going to happen.
Okay, take. All right, come on. Take three. I can't. Right. I'm sorry.
Are you on the wine already?
No, I haven't. I've got
the giggles for some reason.
Yeah, I just all right, sorry. I know, it's awful, Tim, when someone else has got the giggles. Can't get it out. Right, that's it. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. What?
Yeah, now you sound almost apologetic.
Oh, dear. Right. No, come on. I've got to do it. Right. Okay.
Right. Go to me first.
Right. I'll go to you first,
yes,
Gareth.
Yes. Yeah.
3, 2, 1. And it's goodbye from me, Pete.
It's turned into the two Ronnies.
Do you know what? I just used the first one and recorded. I just can't do it. Sorry. I'll dig that one out. That's more editing than I need.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.